amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie show. We're recording again live. It's December the 14th today. My name's Steve W, but let's be honest, no one really cares about that. What they care about in a week like this is the latest competitor in the world's greatest dad competition. Here he is. It's Steve D. How are you, Steve? Obviously, I know the answer because I compete for your attention just like your wife and child do. I mean, not just like they do, but along with them. How are things where you are?
Very tiring, Steve. For people who didn't know, the last two episodes have been pre-records because new fatherhood is it's not like what they tell you in the Disney films, especially when your baby has a little bit of colic, which for anybody who doesn't know is basically like trapped wind, I guess is the best way to explain it, but they can't expel it. Like we would burp it or fart it, they just can't seem to get rid of it, and it causes them considerable angst, and it really, we're talking about a youngling screaming into your ear for a long couple of hours at a time before finally settling and then getting hungry and you thinking, I've got to feed you again and this is just going to cause it all to kick off again. But we have solved that issue and she's doing really well as well. So my wife was like has had major abdominal surgery. She had a C-section. She's already up and walking miles and miles and miles. She wants to drive. Stopped her driving today. She shouldn't be driving for another 4 weeks, but she feels like she could do a handstand and cartwheels and all that. She feels fine. And baby Olivia was 7.5 pounds. She's already since, just to convert between metrics because we do it all the time, she's put on another 500 grams since then, so another half a kilo. So she's doing really well as well, despite her little colic ailments. But Steve, it's quite sleep depriving these first 2 weeks, and it's not kind of in the way that they explain it to you. You think you'll just be up because you're caring about this thing, but some you're not really up because you're caring about. You're up because they want you to be up, and they need things. And it's the broken sleep is quite difficult to deal with.
Yeah, it can be. And I think from here things very much go in their own direction from baby to baby, parents to parents. So from now on, I will be doing the annoying, slightly older parent thing of acting, talking knowledgeably at you, things that I have experience levels of one go round on. And you presumably will be doing the annoying younger parent thing of pointing out that yours is doing something quicker than mine is or was. I think that's probably the way it goes from here. Alice did have colic. Actually, I was saying to you just beforehand, I found that one of the more challenging things about the kind of very early days, because if they're crying, usually there's a kind of list you can run through in your head a little bit of, are you too hot? Are you too cold? Are you hungry? Are you sleepy? And any of those things you can sort of resolve fairly quickly, for them. If it's colic, you can tell it's quite painful for them from the inside and that they don't know what's going on, and it's really uncomfortable and they're very cross about it. There's not an awful lot you can do to kind of quickly release that. We got more joy than it sounds like you did from colic drops, which helped Alistair quite a bit. But yeah, I have a lot of sympathy with colic. I don't miss that bit of early parenting, having the bit where he's shouting and you are trying to get some gas out of him, doing the only thing you can do, but it's not really working. That sounds quite challenging, but you sound like you're doing really well. So going good so far?
Yeah, we're doing really well, despite everybody's the medical professionals' best attempts to thwart it. Steve's had many a text where I've been arguing with a midwife or a health visitor. We asked the simple question of how long can we keep some formula in the fridge? So if we make it in a sterilized bottle, obviously make it with boiling hot water and leave it in the fridge. How long can I leave it in there for before, you know, rewarming it back up and serving it to the baby? And I got answers that ranged from zero, so you can't do it at all, to 24 hours from six different people. So we're still none the wise on that. So we've literally gone out and had to buy a perfect prep because I feel like it's the only way we're going to be able to. We're just doing it on demand in what we call the baby Tassimo machine. But yeah, it's just it is a constant battle with the medical profession, I feel, but I feel like we're getting to the end of that. We've been discharged from the midwife now, so that's one less that we have to see. So yeah, Steve, let's talk about stocks. That's what people are here for. Steve, how's your portfolio done this week?
Portfolio's done well this week. Portfolio's mostly done well, I'll be honest, today and yesterday, with a kind of general macro tailwind push that it feels like I might have been a bit more exposed to than some other people. I did some quick scribbling beforehand and figured that I am up over the last week or so 3.5%, which puts me marginally ahead of the S&P at 3.07, which kind of rounds to 3. But I'm, you know, 0.5% is a lot when you're talking about a gap between 3 and 3.5. That's a decent margin. Double the FTSE 100, which is up 1.8%, and the VWAURL is up 0.76 on the week when I tried to click on the Google chart earlier. That's not done as well as I thought it might have, but 3.5 for me this week, Steve. Who knows what that will bring in the next couple. Maybe we'll give it all back again. We can talk more about this stuff in a little bit, but how's yours getting on?
Just a bit less than yours, Steve. I think I'm about 3.15%. Over the last 7 days, I've got a little spreadsheet that just tracks the performance. So 89% of my portfolio has beaten VWRP, which is just the accumulating version of VWRL. So, I mean, you've got to be happy with that. Today, I was a bit bored. Baby was asleep and Mrs. was asleep. So I decided to make a year-to-date version of that as well. So 63% of my picks are beating VWRP. On the year to date, so got to be pretty happy with that, Steve. I think that's pretty good, really, for stock picker, I think.
Yeah, 2/3 or so. 2/3 ahead, 1/3 behind. As long as you're not really throwing it away on the third that's losing, you give yourself every chance if you can just generally stay ahead in these cases.
It includes Enphase in that as well, which is actually obviously
it's
I didn't buy
everything at the moment. I think, yeah,
yeah, but down 52% year to date. I think so, but obviously not for me. I think I'm up 50% the next time I bought it, quite low.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's in that category at the moment. Over the last couple of days, we've seen a few things kind of come bouncing off their lows. I was looking across the UK stocks just recently. I saw that Anglo American's up 7% today, as we record this on the 14th, taking it to merely down 45% year to date, if anyone thought a kind of buying opportunity in that had gone. Synthoma, my pick, from the FTSE 250 from Christmas, I will say, not from Christmas, from midpoint of the year. Not year to date necessarily, but it's most of the declines come in the second half, so I am badly losing on JKR's thing. Is up 5% today, cutting its losses for the year to a mere 83%. And there's a couple of others as well that have come sort of bouncing off the 52-week lows. I did a screen earlier this afternoon, sort of about an hour or so before we came on air from the UK and the US, looking for stuff that was at or near... near is undefined, by the way, in terms of how precise that has to be, 52-week lows. And a lot of it is stuff like funds and things like that, so ignore all those for the moment. But I found one stock that I recognized from each index, Steve. I know you know the US one because we talked about it earlier, but can you remember what both, can you guess what both of them are? The one
Steve,
UK one nearly low?
Steve, I can't remember where I've put things 2 minutes previous at the moment, so I probably can't, I don't think I can remember either of them, so you're going to surprise me again.
I was attempting to give you enough time to scroll back up your WhatsApps for the moment to remember that Pfizer's at a 52-week low at the moment. We mentioned that earlier. It's got hammered based on some guidance for next year. That's the only meaningful stock that I've heard of in the US that's meaningfully close to its 52-week low. Everything else has either bounced off it, because ExxonMobil was down there the other day. So was Polaris, and I was looking closely at that and thinking, I wonder about that stock there. I wonder whether that could be an opportunity, but that's moved up again since. In the UK, so Pfizer we were talking about earlier, and we both sort of said, oh, I wonder whether I can convince myself I know enough about Pfizer at these prices for it to be worth it. And I'm not sure about that one is the answer. I'm leaning towards not, but I'm not willing to be held to that one yet. The UK one is one that I am absolutely not touching. I wouldn't touch it with someone else's. It's Vodafone, which is about the only thing that you can currently buy low in terms of a kind of buy low, sell high thing. The selling high thing has proved to be quite a challenge so far for investors in that particular stock, but neither of those particularly screams out at you at the moment, Steve. I think you're in a sort of broadly similar position to me of Pfizer, maybe, and Vodafone, absolutely not.
So when interesting for me is when I looked at Pfizer, sorry, when I looked at Bristol-Myers Squibb about 3 years ago, and I was looking at the oncology pipeline, which was what we thought was going to really come through for Bristol-Myers Squibb and deliver that what we called at the time a wall of earnings. And anybody who sort of had a look at that with us and went into that made a killing before it came back down, providing you sold, of course. There was a company that kept coming up that had a competitor drug in every regard to Bristol-Myers Squibb in their pipeline, and that was Seagen, Seattle Genetics, I think it's short for. And Pfizer have just bought Seagen. They've just had it waived through a couple of days ago. It's a big transaction. I think it's in the 30 billion, Steve. It might be in the late 20 billions, but it's a big transaction. And if you're interested in medical companies, they're very difficult to analyze and to, you know, with any kind of knowledge. But Seattle Genetics brings a very big pipeline to Pfizer in the same way that Bristol-Myers Squibb got a big pipeline when they made their acquisition. So potentially here, very interesting looking company for Pfizer. They've essentially done, they've essentially followed their EPS. Their EPS has thirded and their share price has thirded, and they're not guiding for super strong earnings. But, you know, in the future when that Seattle Genetics acquisition goes through and the pipeline comes to fruition, expect a wall of earnings there. I think this could be Bristol-Myers Squibb take two, Steve. And like you, I'm on the fence with this one. I could do this one, Steve. This is one that I could add to the portfolio. Just hold my nose for 6 to 8 months and just see what happens.
It's interesting, isn't it? I was looking at the price on that again because I didn't think your 30 kind of resonated with me. I had 57 in my head as a number. The actual closing price on this, by the way, is pretty much in the middle of 30 and 57. It's 43 billion, which big. Is what this is closing at. Big. You have a better excuse for that than I do, in that I just misremembered it. But I thought I remember this one being, you know, big, big stuff. This is what they're doing with their COVID winnings.
I was converting it to pounds.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's pretty accurate then in that case. Probably I was converting it to whatever is slightly weaker than a dollar at the moment, a Canadian dollar maybe. Yeah, it's interesting. This is what they're doing with their COVID winnings, right? You'd expect them to do something with their COVID winnings. And they are seeing one of the things that's not going well for them guiding forwards is they are seeing vaccine demand falling quite sharply for COVID vaccines. And as someone with a wife and child who both currently have, well, wife certainly has COVID, child most likely has COVID. We're not testing him. We'll just keep him indoors with the rest of us. And someone who is about to get COVID and has had every jab and booster available to them, basically, I'm not sure whether that counts as fully vaccinated at the moment or not. Sort of mildly disappointing that we don't seem to be doing a better job of containing it for the time being. So the thing I was really reading is that Americans appear to be getting tired of additional COVID jabs. There's the amount that goes from having had a jab to two jabs to a third jab to now another one or signed up for one next year is coming down to the point that only 20% are still signing up for more of these things, which is bad for Pfizer, I guess. You would expect them to do something with their kind of winnings, as I say, and what they've done is buy Seagen. You also generally expect the market to say prove it when you see any kind of acquisition going through. It's usually the case that the acquiring company's stock goes down because they're giving away the known commodity, which is cash. They're acquiring the not unknown but less known commodity, which is stock, or in this case an entire business, and we will see what kind of comes of that. I saw the revenue numbers they were projecting out for this and they didn't look incredible to me, to be honest with you, in terms of return. I'm not sure what margin they foresee on some of these things, because it can convert in quite different ways here, and I assume they're expecting they'll get some sort of synergy out of their distribution network and the like. But I didn't think they looked like barnstorming obvious. It didn't look to me like Pfizer were particularly getting a steal here for Seagen. They would know better than I would, and to an extent you kind of have to shut your eyes and hope a little bit with these, that their kind of managers know what they're doing. And if you're not happy to do that, if you, one, don't know yourself, and two, are not happy to do that, you can't buy the stock. And I'm trying to work out whether I'm in the category of the second, who are kind of happy to sit and watch on this one. And then I kind of think maybe if the price is right, and the price might be right, to be honest, if I'm given a cheap enough shot at this one, then maybe, and especially because I'm really struggling to find anything else to do at the moment. markets wise.
Yeah, so I agree with you there completely. Yeah, there's not an awful lot of buying opportunities at the moment, especially in the last few days when everything has just gone a little bit crazy. But yeah, Pfizer basically going all in on oncology. This is basically this Seagen acquisition is what they're doing. So Pfizer have four medicines at the moment for oncology. They've got 25 that are due to be approved shortly, and then 40 more indications, of which they highlight 9 that are a blockbuster or have the potential to be blockbuster drugs. So if that comes off, then you know you're looking pretty a pretty decent return on this today's price. So that also ups the pipeline now to 60 programs, and that's of like quite a few different modalities as well. So rather than focus on say like a small molecule, they're now doing ADCs, small molecules, bispecifics, and immunotherapies as well. So they're having a real go at trying to find ways to fight cancer here across multiple different ways. So cancer's not going anywhere, is it? So it's something where the vast majority of us will get in our lifetime. So we should probably support them.
Yeah, I can't work out whether I kind of hope to get cancer or not, right? I mean, it's a sign you've at least lived long enough to get it. I suppose I hope to get it, but not soon, basically, because the hope is that nothing else kind of gets me first here. Fun Pfizer fact, the only fun Pfizer fact I have for you. One of their board members is a guy called James Quincy. Do you know who he is? Again, this is a mean time to be offering you a quiz. He's the CEO of another big S&P 500 company. I reckon you could probably get through at least 200 of them. Probably thinking you can't remember the other 300, 500 companies, but I reckon you get through 200 of them before you got to the right answer. The answer is Coke. Quincy is the Coke CEO and a Pfizer board member, which is fascinating to me. I've no idea what I make of that. I've heard a couple of interviews with the guy. He seems these have been, by the way, interviews where he's been speaking in his capacity as the Coke CEO, not as anything to do with Pfizer. People have occasionally brought up the, you're a Pfizer director as well, right? And it's like, yeah, pretty interesting company, isn't it? No idea what qualifies him to be on that board, to be honest, but I'm sort of fascinated to find him there.
I would never have guessed, no. I didn't even recognise the name either, so yeah, interesting, that one. I wouldn't be able to tell you why he was there or what the link is, unless he's there for some kind of commercialisation or marketing purpose, I guess.
That's highly possible, actually. Busy boy, running Coke and also being director at not a small company in the form of Pfizer. Anyway, that's probably all I got on that one for that unscheduled segment. I always enjoy a kind of unscheduled Pfizer segment. I say this like we have them once a month or something, but mostly because they used to make Viagra, so you can stick all kinds of interesting puns in the thumbnails and that kind of thing. See how you get on with that. If not, I'll try and help you with them this time, because
Pfizer's stiff competition.
Yeah, Pfizer's struggling to keep it up, and so on and so forth. Less of the cheap jokes for the moment. Let's talk about why stocks are... Let's not talk about why stocks are going up. Let's talk about what you've consumed now you've been on this kind of extended paternity leave thing that's going to run through Christmas. Steve, what have you been consuming?
So, to be fair, Steve, it's a lot harder to consume things than you would think. You've got all this free time, but you sort of spend it watching TV with a baby attached to your shoulder, usually vomiting down your back. So there is time to have a phone in your hand or remote in hand. And I've managed to get through... pretty much the whole series of Mandalorian. I've got through the whole series of Andor, Star Wars, Andor, and I've just started The Boys on Amazon as well, because I do the first shift, so I don't bother going to bed till like 1:30, 1, so I've normally got 3 or 4 hours to watch some TV. But that's not my consumption. My consumption this week is by Kyla.substack.com. It's Kyla Scanlon. Again, I think we mentioned the Hair Slicenomics podcast probably on the last one we actually recorded on the week. And she's done a really good article and video called It's More Than Just Vibes. And it's an article about basically breaking down why, despite America's economy doing really, really well, I mean, if you just think about the numbers and forget the narrative, doing very well, despite the fact that interest rates have gone up, you know, quite rapidly, and that should have caused a recession and hasn't, and should have caused mass unemployment and it hasn't. And she basically breaks down why people feel so bad about the economy in America, despite it actually doing okay. And it's a really interesting piece. And I think it's called It's More Than Just Vibes. But recently had the word vibe session put into the dictionary as well. So she's doing quite well for herself as a sort of fledgling economist. And like I said, this is a really interesting article, and link's going to be in the description, and I recommend you all check it out.
Yeah, I will. You've mentioned Carter Scanlon before. I think Sliceonomics may have been one of the last things that we had a look at as well. It is really good to find these kind of, economists who are capable and strong when it comes to presenting things to ordinary-ish people, or people who haven't had any kind of proper economics training. It feels like a kind of thing that we look for in a fair bit in things to subscribe to on our email accounts and that kind of thing. Definitely one I'm interested in having a look at too. And I'm glad you picked a reading thing, because I've picked you could use it as just a listening thing, to be honest, and like a podcast, but it's better if you watch too, because there is sort of video and it's worth having. Phineas on YouTube, spelled Finaius, have a series of documentaries, and they don't release these very often because I think they take quite a while to make, because they are well made. I saw someone had written in the comments of a recent one, better than Netflix. I think that's pushing it, but I would stick this, when people talk about YouTube as being a kind of like a TV setup, this kind of thing comes to mind for me. They have a bunch of documentaries on loads and loads of interesting, mostly US financial organizations, people, that kind of thing, who are either significant now or have been significant in history. So think about the rise of Goldman Sachs, Paul Volcker, Jamie Dimon, Sam Zell, Steve Schwarzman, all those kinds of people. It will probably not surprise you, Steve, to know I basically, when I was, Alistair was a little bit older and capable of sleeping in a sling, and did sleep in a sling quite well, but I had a long period just over a year ago now of binging on these things. But the one that I've come back to, perhaps unsurprisingly, in the last week and a half or couple of weeks since we recorded anything, is Charlie Munger. Who of course died on November the 28th. The investing world is a poorer place without him. It gives you a kind of biography of the man as much as his kind of great quotes. And he's very, very quotable as an investor. The thing that always stands out to me when I think about Charlie Munger as a life rather than just as an investor is that I feel embarrassed at how sassy I am with people. I feel like it's very, very unearned, my right to sass people and talk like I'm Charlie Munger. Not just because he was an incredibly successful investor, but when you think about all the stuff that he kind of lived through and saw and so on, I find him a very impressive human being in terms of, I guess, in days gone by and days that he would have lived through, British people would have referred to it as stiff upper lip, but he is very much the kind of person who got on with things, including kind of partially losing his sight, expecting to lose his sight completely, the loss of his son to leukemia, living through a war, all of those kind of things. We talk a lot about first world problems, or things that would qualify as first world problems. The reason they're called first world problems is because they genuinely are problems, and if you live in the first world, you have to tackle them. But when I think about Charlie Munger and some of the stuff that he kind of lived through, I imagine that video has seen a big surge in views anyway, so it might come to the top quite naturally for anyone searching on Phineas. But gosh, it's an impressive video on an impressive person. Steve, thoughts on either? Actually, you've linked that video to me before years ago now. Don't know if you can remember it. It's got a picture of what is presumably an actor of a young Charlie as the thumbnail, but you can remember that. Any thoughts on that, or any thoughts on Charlie Munger? You must have some.
Yeah, only that it was really sad. I think I broke the news to you, didn't I, when I spotted it. I spotted it pretty quickly on the minute the news was out. And yeah, it was really sad to see that. I'm not sure he would have been overly bothered about reaching 100, but I guess I suppose he was. He probably would have been. 100 was one of his sayings, wasn't it? The first 100's a bitch. You've just got to do it. But it would have been interesting to see him see him get there and just see his thoughts on that. But I mean, what an incredible life, lucid till the very end, which a real sort of powerhouse in investing. I just think it's going to be strange to watch the next Berkshire meeting without him on Warren's side. And I wonder the great orator that Buffett is, just what his tribute will be, because his tribute on the Berkshire press release was really just short and sweet and informative. So it'd be interesting to see just what Buffett's got to say about him, because I think he owes a lot to him and is investing is well the way he changed Buffett's style completely. Strange as well, Steve, right on the eve of his almanac being released for the final time as well, that just the awful timing that it sort of coincided with each other. But is that something you'll be getting for Christmas, the almanac now? Will that make it a trickier read for you, Steve, because it is literally his life story in words?
Yeah, it'll be a much trickier read now. It'll feel like it has more of a sense of completeness to it, I guess. Buffett says he's never released a book because he keeps thinking, yeah, but there's still stuff happening that I'd want to include in it, and so on. And if you get to the point where you can't often write it, but then you want to put the next bit in and so on, and you can update it and the like. I'll be getting it sooner or later. I'm going to let Christmas go by, give someone a chance to give it to me, but if they don't, then I'll go out and get a copy myself. I was trying to work out when I was thinking about this, from a Berkshire perspective, I think I'm not too worried. In the 10 Ks and Qs where they list risks and so on, Berkshire does identify key man risk as an important risk, but they identify it around Buffett rather than around Charlie Munger or Ajit Jain. They say they have succession plans there to mitigate that kind of thing, but they do say if Buffett were unable to do something for an extended period of time, that might be a genuine concern with the company, although Buffett always talks that down in meetings and so on when he's talking about succession and the like. It'll be interesting. I think Charlie Munger is probably more of a loss to Berkshire than the lack of movement in the share price immediately afterwards, would imply in that situation. I think when I kind of consider some of this stuff, one of the things that stands out to me is, of course, he ran the Daily Journal's portfolio until the end, basically. And did nothing with it, having bought a load of basically US banks at pretty good prices during the pandemic. I hope no one sold them based on what we've seen today. I hope no one got hold of that and said, right, let's get rid of some of these things and turn them into something else, because they've all been ripping higher today and they are all significantly well up. They're definitely 52-week highs at the moment. I own a couple of them and I have decent, by my standards, decent-sized stakes in them, and that's the reason they've done pretty well this week. So I hope no one's been fiddling with that, or they're getting immediately fired, and I suspect he might start rolling over and saying, what the hell are you doing? I was trying to work out what a suitable tribute for him might be, as sometimes in sports you kind of have a minute's silence and sometimes you have a minute's applause, and I thought maybe a one-minute rant about crypto might be appropriate for him. But I didn't get round to writing that in the end. But anyway, back to where we were, and this time with no real apology for digressing on this one. Phineas, their video on Charlie Munger, in fact, any of their videos is what I would offer for consuming on this. I find them informative, interesting. I find them in some ways inspiring in a lot of cases. The Charlie Munger one is really, really good. Before we move on, a quick one from Steve and me. If you're enjoying the show, please do give us a like, a comment, and a rating on whatever platform you're listening on. And make sure you share the podcast with your investing friends. It helps us a lot, and we're really looking forward to building out something that you guys can get some value from and that we can have some fun in making. So do like, subscribe, and back on with the show.
The sucker's going up.
But anyway, let's talk about stocks then for the last half of the show, or at any rate stuff that's been bulling stocks higher for the moment. So it's basically been interesting macro season in the sort of 2 weeks that we've been away, and we'll just take wind ourselves back slightly to have a little bit of a sweep of what's been going on. So stuff's been happening in both the UK and the US, because in some senses the UK follows the US, but there's an interesting point I guess it's worth bringing up here. Wind us back a few days then for the moment, and the GDP report is out from the UK. Steve, I saw you posted about this on the 212 forum. GDP was down 3% in October in the UK, according to at least the ONS's latest kind of estimate. Sorry, 0.3%. Yeah, you are right. I've written 3% here, and I've been writing 0.3% in everything I've written this week. But yes, you are right. It was down 0.3% in October. Signs of an oncoming recession. Over to you.
I don't know, to be honest with you, because every time I think that we're heading into a recession, we just seem to just avoid it, don't we? So it has to be two quarters for the UK as well. So it's key to note that despite being down 0.3% in October, it was actually flat on the quarter. So we're still, I would assume, flat, and a down quarter doesn't mean recession. I can't imagine it does. So we're still at least 6 months away from a confirmed recession in the UK. No recession at the moment, but definitely an economy that's not doing so well heading into Christmas, which could be a number of reasons, Steve. We do quite like to blame the weather. It was quite a wet month, so we shall see. Nothing really of interest in that GDP report. Nothing really shocking you. I didn't see anything in there that really made me think, you know, that there's something wrong here. I think this is more of the same.
No, nothing really shocked me either. So far this year, GDP has been falling in general. It's gone from slightly up to flat to now slightly down. It'll be interesting to see whether that direction of travel continues. The market's reaction was really interesting at the time, I thought. The market took this quite positively, because I think the general view, if I can read this right out of where share prices were going, would be a mild recession, and that, look, down 0.3% is mild recession territory. That's not a sharp decline in output at all. Would be no bad thing, because it would encourage or force the Bank of England to cut rates, which would be highly stimulative to share prices. So up everything goes again, basically. And we would get away with not much of an earnings decline. It wouldn't be a soft landing, strictly, if you had a very mild recession, but it would be nearly as good as one. Right? So it wouldn't be a soft landing, because you wouldn't avoid the downturn. But you would very much limit the downturn, which is the kind of bad bit of the hard landing. So it would be a medium firm landing, I guess, here, right? You get if you can bring inflation down. There's some questions over that too. And then, of course, things got even more positive. Both the UK and the US in the last couple of days have announced they're leaving interest rates flat with where they are. In the UK, there was some slight... in terms of the members of the panels in each case, there's some slightly different outlooks on this. So the UK has 9 members. Six of them voted to keep rates level. 3 of them voted to push rates higher to 5.5%. So it's mostly flat, and it's a kind of 2-1 majority, super majority for flat. But the other kind of contender is up to try and bring inflation down a little bit, which is currently at 4.6%, by the way. Bank of England talk said there's still some way to go, still targeting that 2% inflation that they have always said they're kind of aiming for. But they don't see the need to raise rates just at the moment. The US also held rates flat. Their dot plots, which tell you where the members of the Federal Reserve Committee see interest rates going, they all see them coming down. And no one has seen they go higher at all from here. They said it's too early to declare victory on this because, I mean, partly that's true. Inflation in the US is 3.1%. Here's what I think is interesting about this, Steve. Share prices went kind of gangbusters as a result of this. There's signs of a cut coming. Hooray. Lower interest rates, generally good for the economy, good for asset prices, good for all kinds of people who own stuff. Not good for people who are sat around with cash and want to own stuff. But here's the interesting thing from my mind. The Bank of England is talking a toughish game here of, nope, we don't see that there's any kind of rate cuts on the horizon, however the US does. And so far, the UK, for whatever reason, has mostly fallen into line with the US, albeit slightly behind them. The question on my mind is, will the Bank of England hold rates steady as it says it will if the US cuts, as it has not said it will, but in a sense implied it will, or kind of given an indication that that's on the table in a way that the UK has not yet? This is the kind of thing that you typically find kind of interesting here as to whether the UK will do anything that dares to differ from what the US might be doing at the moment, apart from the same thing, but sort of slightly slower. What do you think here?
I think you've pretty much nailed it, Steve. I think essentially if the US starts cutting, expect the UK to follow, because that's what always happens. We're usually ever so slightly behind, but they are, you know, they are the leader, and we hold their hand and do exactly as they tell us to usually. So That's what I would expect. So just quickly flying back to the dot plot, Steve. The dot plot was really interesting because the committee were expecting the three rate cuts that were announced next year. But in 2024, they were expecting, 2025, they were expecting four more cuts, which will be another full percentage point off. And then in 2026, there'll be three more cuts as well. So that'll take the rates down to between 2 and 2.25%, which is pretty close to the Fed's sort of long run outlook that we were that they were expecting to. So there is quite a bit of dispersion in those last two, but that's generally generally what they were saying. So it was quite interesting to see that though, because the market straight after went and priced in about 1.5 percentage points of cuts in the next year. So they think that essentially what Jay Powell said is a bit of tough talking again. Maybe a little bit of, do as I do, not as I say kind of thing with Jerome Powell. And they think that he's going to end up having to cut it twice as fast as he says he's going to. So that is interesting. Interesting stuff there, Steve. Do you have anything on that?
Well, a couple of quick thoughts here. Most of what this feeds into is our stuff that's coming up in 2 weeks, which is our predictions for next year. The reason you would be interested in the macroeconomy, well, there's a couple of reasons. From a long-term perspective, you might be interested in seeing which stocks are kind of coming under pressure at the moment that they don't deserve. But with the kind of stuff we've been seeing here, the answer is none of them, because none of them seem to be under any pressure whatsoever. Apart from Pfizer and Vodafone, but that's not a macro issue. That's an internal business issue. The other reason is if you were interested in making predictions for the next year or so. Well, it's not my prediction. It won't be my prediction. I haven't even decided what my prediction for outperforming will be. But I would be fascinated to see how a pairs trade that said long Ark K and short Berkshire goes with rising interest rates. Obviously, Cathie Wood did extremely, extremely well with interest rates at zero or close to zero, and has done extremely, extremely badly with interest rates up above 5%. Used to manage, I think, 50 billion, now manages about 5, which is brutal, to be honest. And since then, Buffett has become the man again. But of course, it's not so long ago that everyone was telling us that Buffett was washed up and can't think of anything to do and doesn't understand the world anymore, and so on and so forth. And these things go round and round and round and round and round. I'd be interested to see how the spread goes on a long Ark, short Berkshire thing. I will not be doing either of those things. Or I don't anticipate doing either of those things. I suppose never say never. And it won't be my prediction either. But that's the thought that kind of sticks out to me. UK-wise, I have one idea which I was sort of pleased to see the market agrees with, even though the market is a voting machine, which is that, so looking at rates, if you think rates are going to come down in the UK for the moment, the bank that stands to better, so the story for banks this year has mostly been, strangely, people focusing on the negatives for UK banks. What they've been focusing on is bad loan losses increasing, charges for bad loans going up, rates going up too fast for consumers, defaults, dangers of defaults, things go past due, so on and so forth. Ignore the fact that bank profitability has been higher, by the way. They've just been taking on a load more charges. And in that case, you would think that levelling or tapering or even falling rates would be helpful in that regard. Fewer people rolling onto mortgages that they can't manage, so on and so forth. But the bank that really stands to benefit from that the most, according to the market, and I think I agree with them here, is Barclays. And since people like it a lot when I talk about Barclays on this show or anywhere, I thought I'd say something on that subject as well. I mean, the reason that makes sense to me is because Barclays has a massive investment banking arm, which has been doing kind of nothing, because investment banking in general has been doing kind of nothing for a couple of years since rates started going up. Peak IPO season is a long way behind, and in fact, it's kind of like super peak IPO season that we've left behind now. So rising rates has meant better results for net interest margin, i.e. loan to deposit spreads, and worse stuff for investment banking. That's hammered Barclays way more than it's hammered Lloyds, say, which doesn't have an investment banking arm. They stand to be a big beneficiary of lower rates. Recession-wise, I won't use this as a prediction going forward, but I reckon spoons might hold up well in a recession. It's strictly a consumer discretionary. You're not supposed to think consumer discretionaries do well. in a recession, but they are doing very well this year. They are operationally quite resilient. Their debt's still kind of high, but they're managing it well. They're investing into their businesses. Pub sector in general is struggling, but they are bucking that trend. I wouldn't be surprised if they keep doing it because they're cheaper than everybody else, and they're cheaper than everybody else because they own their own buildings, at least partly, which means they don't have leaseholders or bondholders on their case as much. I sort of think they might do sneaky better than people think if there's a recession coming. Don't think I'll use them as part of a kind of prediction for 2 weeks, or at least I'll come up with a different one. Now, the one thing that surprised me was that Unilever appears to be down, and that's surprising given that, I suppose it's not a surprise, but I thought with inflation kind of the bank sticking its foot into inflation still and saying we are bringing that down, they might be okay, because that seems to be the biggest risk with them. Maybe they think that falling rates are going to be an issue there. I'm not sure I see that, so I'm pondering that at the moment. Those are my logical thoughts, and I suppose I've written this as a kind of footnote in my notes here. I dislike talking about things that I've come up with that have done well, but look, it would be disingenuous for me to now stop talking about REITs, having talked about them more or less non-stop for the last 2 months on this show, at least on the stuff that we didn't pre-record. REITs have been going mad. Anyone who bought a load of REITs in the last 10 weeks or so has probably done reasonably well in them. Congratulations to you guys. I'm now just annoyed that I'm finding it harder to buy them at these prices, to be honest, because they're starting to kick back up and the 7% dividend yields are going away. That's my rough collection of thoughts there, Steve. Start where you like on those.
Well, I was just going to shuffle us on, Steve, just because I realised we'd not really spoke about the European Central Bank as well, which announced today that they were also going to hold rates.
Yep.
They're still at record high, 4%. So they're going to hold their rates for a little bit now, which 4% is really high for the euro region. I don't think if people fully understand just how high that is. I mean, they're used to negative rates and maybe just above, definitely real terms negative rates. So to be at 4 is quite a lot. So they also released some updates to their real GDP. They think that it's going to expand about 0.6% this year, which was against their forecast of 0.7. So that's actually not too bad. It's close enough. It is a downgrade, but it's pretty close. They think that GDP will be up by 0.8% in 2024, which they did think was 1%. So that's a more significant downgrade. But they think the forecast for 2025 is going to be 1.5%. So we will wait and see why that is. Headline inflation, Steve, they think they're going to finish the year at 5.4%, then drop to 2.7% in 2024 and eventually to 2.1% in 2025. They had been forecasting 5.6, 3.2 and 2.1, so they actually think inflation is going to come down just a little bit faster than they anticipated, about 0.5% faster. They also released an estimate for inflation in 2026, which seems a long way away, but 1.9% if you really care about that. They also said that they're going to bring an end to their pandemic emergency purchase program, which was something I thought had already ended, but it actually ends at the end of 2024. And then they're going to transition away. There's going to be a reduction in the pet portfolio by about 7.5 billion euros per month on average over the second half of 2024. So they're looking to sort of advance the sort of normalization of their balance sheet. So. Some interesting stuff in the release, Steve. I think, again, it's been a sort of a considered pressure from around the world to get these inflation figures down, at least the Western world. So, interesting to see everybody just starting to sort of sell off those weird purchasing programs that they all span up over the pandemic. But I guess more interesting will be to see just how America starts to deal with this huge debt pile they've managed to accumulate. But the euro... central bank is in no better of a position realistically, because unlike America, they'll find it very difficult to grow out of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. I tend to pay less attention to the euro, so mostly because I don't own anything that trades on an exchange there. You do, though, certainly in the case of, well, at least two big stocks that begin with A that I can think of here, which is Adyen and ASML
and the Swiss boys.
That's true as well. The stuff in Switzerland I have an eye on every so often, but I tend to not quite reach for. I'm fascinated by the fact that they're only just winding down their pandemic emergency purchase program. I think you called it there. That strikes me as quite behind. Although, I mean, given that their kind of inflationary numbers are only in the broad region of the UK or the US, I think that maybe doesn't seem like the worst idea in the world.
No, definitely not. They definitely need to. I still can't believe it's going on, though. That's the thing. But it's not just that it's going on. They're gonna end it next year. So it seems to be...
That's not that far away at the moment.
I know, but it just seems like, why didn't it end this year? Do you know what I mean? Why are we hanging on to it? I suppose that they're just trying to taper off probably towards the end. But yeah, interesting to see it just being extended as long as it has. Euronext, Steve, is another one that I have... In the Euro area. So I think I have Adyen, ASML, Euronext, VAT, and Zender. I think they're my five from
Kering over there. Area.
Is who?
Is Kering?
Oh, Kering, yes. Yep. Yes, Kering. That's another one. Well, it was Sartorius, but that went quite a while ago. So, and I really should have bought that back in the low 200s, and I don't know why I didn't. I've been kicking myself for quite, because we spoke about it as well. You even said to me, why haven't you bought Sartorius? And it was kind of like, I don't know.
We have a lot of conversations that go like that, one way or another. What number does this become interesting to you? Like, well, a number bigger than this one, are you buying it? No, basically is how that conversation often goes. Yeah, so there's interesting stuff kind of coming through here. The kind of stuff I was hearing predictions-wise for 2024, which, to be honest, a lot of it, the kind of early predictions, and I say early, I mean sort of start of this month, predictions for 2024, might need revising kind of already in light of the kind of latest macro data. Every kind of US-sided thing, whether it's Goldman or some sort of other institute for research and so on, all tends to be thinking that the US will be leading the way with kind of rates coming down and so on. And I happen to agree with that, by the way. I don't think that's just a kind of home bias. I think that's plausible predicting. Followed by the Eurozone, followed by the UK, maybe some mention of Japan in there as well. So I'm sort of, I'm interested as to whether the UK really will drag its heels on this one and whether the Eurozone will be that much more proactive. I don't have any particular plan to set up any trades to kind of exploit that difference if they're wrong about it, but that's some stuff that kind of stands out to me, I think, on all of this. Steve, shall we get to talking about questions that people have been asking? Because it's been, well, at least one show since we answered a viewer question, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been one show since we did that. Steve, I really wanted to ask you about what you thought about Tesco's news. It says Tesco has recalled its Christmas stuffing mix because it may contain moths. So, Steve, but we won't talk about that. We'll go straight to the listener question. We'll leave that for people to decipher. But it was from Jordan, who messaged us on, I think it was Spotify that he left us a message on. And he said, good luck, so thank you to me. This was obviously prior to the baby. I needed the luck. But he said, I would love to know or hear about any investments, chasers you plan on opening for your baby. So, Steve, you're ahead of me. Well, you're not ahead of me, but you've got a year on me or so. What have you opened up?
In Alistair's name, and I'll come back to a kind of fun point about this in the end, we have two things. We have a junior ISA, which is with AJ Bell. I'll come back to that one in a second. And we have a savings account that, I'll be honest, is mostly paid into by his grandparents, who would much rather put their money into a savings account than some sort of stocks and shares type thing. Sorry, his junior ISA is a stocks and shares ISA, I should say. In the savings account, we've talked about this. It feels like we talked about this quite a lot, quite a long time ago, about how the sort of generation above us, in a lot of cases, are much more anti-investing. And the reasons there might be for that to do with a lack of access to the financial markets. They didn't have the kind of platforms that we have now. Lack of information about the stuff, which isn't to say that we're kind of better than they are, just that we have stuff made easier for us in terms of finding out what investing is about and that kind of thing, as well as some interest rates that were like 11% or something, which look, it's not crazy to think in the world, I'll take 11% from cash. I don't really care what I can get in the stock market. The stock market appears to be a thing that I only ever read about when it crashes and people lose all their money. Why would I want to do that? I'll happily take my double-digit percentage in cash for the time being. But they much prefer to pay into a savings account for Alistair. We prefer to pay into a junior ISA. AJ Bell is our preferred, our chosen provider for this stuff. It was the best one I had a look around. What he owns in there at the moment, because we don't make transactions very often because there is a flat rate for them, so we tend to sort of do them once a year, whack the amount for the year in, and then let it go for a little bit. So he only actually owns two different things, and both of them are preferred stocks. That's the kind of middle ground we've looked for, or at least I've decided we're looking for realistically. This is on me if it goes wrong. That's the kind of middle ground we've looked for between bonds, which at the time were not terribly rewarding and are still not that rewarding actually as of today, and something like stocks, which have the capacity to grow. There are, of course, various kind of control and withdrawal issues around a junior ISA, which means that we have to leave it for a long time. So I opted for what I consider to be predictability over maybe maximal return here. But Steve, plans on a junior ISA? This seems like one of the highlights of having a kid, right? You get to manage someone else's money, technically.
It's already open. Yeah, so we've
there we go.
We have a junior ISA already open for Olivia, and it's with Hargreaves Lansdown because they've removed all of their fees on their junior ISA, and it's very, very cheap. So we're going to just put in a lump sum in April when we get our dividends, and we should. It's all going to go into essentially the Vanguard Global All Cap OEIC and the OIC, and that's what we're going to do with it. So she also has a junior SIP, which I'm in the process of opening because Hargreaves Lansdown will let you open a junior ISA online, but a junior SIP, Steve, you have to fill in a paper form. So I don't have a printer, so I've had to ask my brother to bring me the paper form next time he's passing, which he's going to do for me, and I will fill the paper form in and send it back. The other thing I've opened for her is just a premium bond account, and I opened that. So we registered her on the 12th, and I did it the minute I got home, and I haven't heard a single thing from NSNI yet. And today I just thought I'd ring them up because they're happily taken the money for the first deposit off me, but they've not actually given me any information whatsoever. And the lady couldn't find the application, but said that sometimes it takes a few days to appear on the system. So they're a typical poorly run, inadequate government department, essentially, there. So she said if it doesn't appear by Monday on my side, to ring them to see if it's appeared on their side, which makes no sense. But it was one of those times when you've been on hold for sort of 15 hours and you think, I just want to go now. So, yeah, that's what I've opened, essentially, is a junior ISA, which I'm only looking to put in about £10,000 as soon as I can. So I think I'll probably do it over a three-year period. The same with the junior SIP, but I'm going to try and get that up to about £10,000. And then I'm just going to let that do its business from that point onwards. It's not something I would want to regularly contribute to. And the premium bonds, I figure I will just put in. Well, essentially, every time we get coins, we've been saving coins because there is a mystery bridge in Lincolnshire, Steve, that moves quite regularly. I'm not entirely sure where it is, but every so often I drive up to it and it costs, like, I think it's 20p or 30p to go over. So I always need some cash because they don't take card. But whenever I've got excess coins, I'm banging them in a pig, which I will eventually cash out and use to add to her premium bond account and things like that as well. So I've sort of got it in my head. I've got my cash back from my Chase account as well. Whenever I get cash back for spending on Chase, that's also going to go into her premium bonds as well. So I feel like she's going to be a bazillionaire by the time she gets to 18. But that also could be the price of a loaf of bread if inflation keeps going. So we'll see.
Well, yeah, you need to make plans for your care when you get older. And it's going to land on whoever, well, her and anyone else that you might choose to bring into the world. Tell me a bit more about the idea behind the premium bonds thing. I mean, I get the case for the SIP and I get the ISA and I get that there's a a difference between them, just in case anyone's interested. Junior ISA, money belongs to the child, which is an obvious sounding point, but it's significant. They can take control of their account at 16 and can withdraw from it at 18, as I understand it. So at 16, Alistair can say, "Oh, sod this. Why do I own a load of Lloyd's preferreds? I'm banging it all in Realty Income," or whatever he wants to do with it. He can't then take anything out till he reaches 18, though. A SIP works like a, pretty much like a SIP. How's a junior SIP different from a SIP, Steve?
Same sort of idea, Steve, really, because you can't withdraw from a SIP until you're in your, is it 50, late 50s, and it'll be different for...
by the time our two get up there, it's going to be about 300 with retirement age and stuff, but yeah.
Yeah, bionic hearts and bionic legs and things like that, so yeah, they'll be living for till 500, but that's generally the idea, is just basically to get as much money in that as soon. I think it's got a quite low limit. I think you can only put about 200, I think it's 2,800 quid or something like that in when you put the government clawback on it, the 20% clawback. It comes up to a more reasonable, straightforward number. I think it's 2,880, right, maybe. And then it ends up being a more reasonable number. But I'm going to basically try and get 10 grand into that as soon as I can. And then obviously there's 50, 55 probably years of compounding from that point onwards till maybe even 65 years of compounding before she'll be able to retire with that. So the idea being that she can go and do whatever she wants, and doesn't have to go and get a high paid, high stress job in order to secure a pension. She can go and, you know, do something that's a bit more fulfilling.
Just find a way to break even each month, right? And when you get to the end of your kind of working life, at whatever point that might be,
buy a Lambo.
Yeah, I was going to say things will be kind of looked after and so on. But yes, buy a Lambo is something you can do. Buy a Lambo and drive it around Hull. Are there many of those kicking around there?
I mean, we have a Porsche dealership, but I don't think I've ever seen it. Maybe one or two. When Hull City were in the Premiership, there was a couple knocking about, but I haven't seen any for not where Hull currently are in the Championship. So.
Fair enough. The premium bonds thing, as an emergency fund?
It's not an emergency fund. It's just somewhere to stash some cash for the meantime. I think a bit young to have a bank account, essentially, so... won't be bothering with that until you know, any concept of money arrives. And then I've been recommended Rooster Money. I don't know if you've come across that, Steve, by NatWest. It's basically I can't remember what the account was called. Go Henry. It's basically like Go Henry, a version of Go Henry that's sellotaped onto your NatWest account, so you can monitor what they're doing and what they're spending. But they get their own little card with an allowance on it, and you can, you know, like set them tasks to like go and get all the logs from the log store and things like that, and you give them £5 when they complete it, and, you know, clean the pots and what have you. So it's just a way to reward slave labor.
Can I get all the logs from the log store? Alistair's first question would be, well, we don't have a log store. But yeah,
I'm dreaming up all the tasks I hate. It's like, right, log store, mop floor.
Yeah, this is good. And then you can take it all back again as national insurance and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Learn about tax.
Yep, learn about tax. This is good. This connects to a question that we will come to in a future week about how to teach them about... money. I wonder if this might be useful for that. I'm going to go and look into it in a bit, but we are sort of approaching the hour mark. We're a little bit short of it, but nonetheless, that pretty much brings us to everything I had for this week. Main story being, Steve is still with us. He's doing a super job, and things are generally going pretty well on your side, Steve.
Yeah, really well. Much better now that we've managed to get around this sort of colic issue with a comfort milk, which, Steve, smells like Horlicks, but if you leave it out for more than sort of 20 or 30 minutes, it splits into like a cream bottom and an oil top. And if she starts to sort of pour at it because she fancies a little bit more, you always say, "I'll make you a fresh one because that is not shaking back together."
Yeah. Okay. We'll be back next week for our Christmas show, where we will look back at the things that have gone by this year, and then we'll be back the week after for our New Year's show, where we will look forward at the things that are to come, as well as considering some of the predictions that we've made that have been, I think, almost certainly terrible. In my case, Steve doing better than me. We'll try and round up Paul if we can find him. If we can, we'll all see you there. If not, the two of us will see you next week. Bye for now, and thank you for listening.